This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With shocking extreme weather, how are the kids doing? Climate change is leading to stress in children similar to PTSD. Dr. Betty Lai has been studying it for a decade of hurricanes and bushfires. Then EcoShock gets the real dirt with soil strategist Dee Dee Pearsehouse. Poor soil, poor food, poor health for all of us. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get going. Children will inherit this climate-damaged world. How are they coping with the record disasters already hitting so many countries? A new study gives us clues. The paper, Trajectories of Post-Traumatic Stress in Children After Natural Disasters, looks at school kids in the U.S. where four major hurricanes wrought havoc. The lead author is Betty Lai, assistant professor in counseling, developmental and educational psychology at Boston College in Massachusetts. Betty has been working and publishing on this key question for more than a decade. Dr. Betty Lai, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
What are the questions your new study attempts to answer?
So in our new study, we're really trying to understand how can we better intervene early to help children after disasters? Because we know that children can report a lot of mental health distress after disasters, and that this can affect many millions of children. So we really don't have the resources to intervene in an intense way for every single child, and it doesn't make sense to do so. So we're really hoping to understand, well, how can we triage the children who need the most care quickly and then offer more supportive interventions for children who may not need that sort of intense level of care?
Yes, but children of the southern states have lived through hurricanes for centuries. Are we just becoming aware of what kids go through?
I think there's the combination of becoming more aware, but also having better tools to help children deal with these stressors. Because we know definitively that children who are exposed to disasters are likely to report mental health distress, but even physical health symptoms and also problems with learning in school.
It's surprising and maybe a bit disturbing that your survey found younger kids can be more deeply impacted than teens. Talk to us about that, Betty.
Sure. You know, I think it's definitely disturbing, but not so surprising when you step back and think about what these results mean. So younger kids, they really have less of a context for understanding what a big event like a disaster means in their lives. Older kids who are teenagers, for example, they've just had more of life to live. So they've had more years where they might not have experienced a big disaster event. And in contrast, younger kids, a disaster when it strikes takes up more of their life. So if you have an 8-year-old who experiences a disaster event, they just haven't lived as long and they don't have that abstract reasoning developed yet to understand what a huge event like this means in terms of what your future life will be like, the purpose of an event, and how you can understand the meaning of life afterwards. But in addition to that, really young kids also have fewer coping skills that they've developed in life, and they're even more reliant on adults and other caregivers to protect them in these events.
One point about how we talk about all this, are psychologists now calling these stress impacts PTSS instead of PTSD, which the public knows?
It's not that psychologists have changed the term. It's just a distinction in terms of naming it, because PTSD really refers to the clinical diagnosis. So you have to meet a certain threshold of symptoms, but PTSS, it refers to PTS symptoms. So more understanding the full continuum of symptoms and how that might affect children. So for example, in our study where we're looking at post-traumatic stress symptoms rather than the disorder, we're looking at all of the different types of symptoms that children might report. So that could include things like having flashbacks to the event, avoiding any reminders of the disaster itself. You know, it could be things like taking a new route home after school so that you don't get reminded of things that you witnessed during the disaster event. But the distinction is post-traumatic stress symptoms cover the whole spectrum of symptoms you could report, but PTSD refers to the diagnosis.
And this all happens in the context of climate change, which you mentioned in the paper. Scientists I talk with indicate we're not sure if the number of hurricanes will increase with climate change. What they do say is, and this matters for the paper, is the number of extremely violent storms will increase, and they may be stronger than anything we've seen before. And rising seas will also increase death and damage in coastal cities like Miami, where you are today. How do you see the relationships between climate change and this ongoing effort to identify kids who need help?
Alex, I think you really hit this issue on the head with talking about intensity. And it's really about the intensity of what children experience that seems to matter in terms of children's mental health distress. So what we know is that the number of stressors that children are exposed to during a disaster event can help us predict which children are likely to report these post-traumatic stress symptoms. So a child who sees rising floodwaters, who has windows break in their home, who might have a tree fall in their home or witnesses fires or sees somebody get injured, those are the children who we know will be more likely to report post-traumatic stress symptoms. And unfortunately, it's not just post-traumatic stress symptoms. We also see children report depression symptoms, anxiety symptoms after these disaster events. So that's why the intensity piece matters in terms of thinking about children's mental health, that the more intense a disaster is, the more likely it is that a child will experience stressors during and after the event.
Well, many children already feel unsafe with food insecurity, housing insecurity. A few are already homeless. Kids may lack medical care and so on. How does that affect those disadvantaged kids when a catastrophic hurricane strikes?
Children who are disadvantaged before a disaster are even more likely to experience all of those stressors I just mentioned. And that's the way in which we see systematic vulnerability make children even more vulnerable. So a child who experiences homelessness, they're more likely to be in a temporary housing situation where they might see impacts on their home during a disaster, but they're also more likely to have to move several times after the disaster itself or change schools. And all of those stressors really compound to increase the likelihood that children will experience mental health symptoms after a disaster.
And what did these surveys of about 1,700 kids after disasters find out about minorities and people of color?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, you know, we really didn't have the direct data on racism or systemic injustice. We didn't have those measured directly in our studies, so we can't speak directly to this point. But we know across the disaster literature that all of these factors are systemic vulnerability issues because they do cause children to be exposed to more stressors.
And you found females were slightly more likely to have lasting damage than males. Any ideas why?
You know, this is an issue that we see often in research on children's mental health, that girls are at slightly higher risk of reporting post-traumatic stress and depression. And there could be many reasons why. We're not sure why in our study, but it's definitely something to look into further.
And although we may not have all the studies we'd like, would it be your assessment as a psychologist that other natural disasters from wildfires to floods could also have lasting impacts on some children?
Yes, absolutely. And we see that both in our work and the work of other researchers, that all of these disaster events do have impacts on children. And when we follow children out, you know, we can see those symptoms lasting as long as 2 years, 3 years, and beyond post-disaster. And sometimes the only reason we don't have a better sense of how far out those symptoms go is just because the research wasn't funded to have even more long-term assessments, so researchers weren't able to go back at 10 years, for example. But we do see these symptoms across many types of disaster events, including, as you said, wildfires and floods.
Yeah, a few years ago, you co-authored a study looking at post-traumatic stress in children after bushfires and after the wildfires in California and Canada. Listeners do want to know about that. Would it be your assessment as a psychologist that, what did you learn about wildfires in kids?
Well, you know, one of the major things for listeners who are listening right now that we know as adults is really asking children about how they're feeling is important. And, you know, sometimes adults don't want to ask children directly, how are you feeling? And they're afraid that asking children might uncover or unearth feelings that might make them worse. But we don't find that to be true. What we've found in our work and the work of others is that children mostly feel relieved when you ask them how they're feeling. So it's important to check in with children, ask them how they're doing, and if they're reporting a lot of distress, helping them to find services can matter.
And you found four basic classifications of this post-traumatic stress, ways that it can affect kids. Could you talk to us about that?
Sure. Overall, the good news is that most children are resilient in that they don't report many symptoms of distress after disasters. So we had one pattern that we found of reactions for children after disasters that we called low decreasing. And what that means is children reported low symptoms that generally decreased over time. And 34% of our roughly 1,700 children fell in that pattern of low decreasing. And what that means is these were children who initially presented as not having much distress after the disaster, and that didn't change over time. So they had low symptoms, and those symptoms stayed low over time. And that's really good news because it tells us that, on the whole, children, many of them, are not going to report that many symptoms. So if you see a child who isn't reporting too many symptoms, you can take that at face value for the most part. I definitely check in with them. Sometimes we find adults will say, well, there must be something wrong. This was a horrible event. How can they be fine? But we're finding that is a natural pattern of response that children and adults have to these traumatic events, that many children and adults do report feeling all right and not being too distressed after a big event. But we did find a small minority of children who reported what we call chronic symptoms. And this was 10% of our children in our study. 10% reported chronic symptoms that were elevated and high and causing them a lot of distress after the disaster. And this is a really important small group of children to pay attention to, because that 10% is telling us that these are children who were very distressed and who did need some more intensive help. The good news for the children who were in that chronic 10% is that we have great interventions to help alleviate children's symptoms of post-traumatic stress. But the key issue here is that we need to get these children help. And our best treatments for post-traumatic stress are led by trained professionals who have expertise in this area.
And what are delayed trajectories, and what did your study find out about them in these four storm cases?
Delayed trajectories are trajectories where you don't see many symptoms at first. People appear to be doing all right, and then they sort of have a breakdown where more symptoms show up later. We call that a delayed trajectory in that the symptoms have a delayed start in terms of appearing. But the thing is, we did not observe a delayed trajectory among children. And this is different from what we typically see in adults after disasters. In adults, we do see delayed trajectories. We didn't observe that in our study of children. And this is actually great news, because it means that if we can assess early, screen, and ask children how they're doing, then that we can sort of take at face value, that we're not going to accidentally miss children that will show up way later. But it's also a call to action. It means that we do need to assess early, because those early symptoms that children report tell us a lot about how children will do over time.
And looking at your other work, I have to ask, do these hurricanes possibly affect mothers as well as their kids?
Absolutely. And we do see that mothers are very much impacted. And I think you can see echoes of this in the current pandemic as well. You know, mothers can be impacted on multiple levels, and really needing support is important. And when we think about disaster events, oftentimes schools are shut for an extended period of time. I think about after Hurricane Katrina, there were about 196,000 public school students who had to change schools in Louisiana. So that's a lot of students that had to change schools. But you think, too, about mothers, fathers, other caregivers who were also impacted, because any of us who are parents know that you cannot work when your child cannot go to school.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, too, of mass social events like the Great Depression or a world war. There's a kind of social support and recognition for distressed people that follows. But I wonder, does that happen after hurricanes? Do kids feel like they're left on their own to cope?
People are incredibly supportive and really come together after disasters. And for children, for the most part, they report that it is helpful that they know that others have gone through similar experiences, so they have people to talk with. I think really reaching out to children and asking them how they're doing is important, because what we find a lot of times is that adults assume that children are reacting in the way that the adult themselves self is reacting. And that doesn't actually indicate how a child might be feeling. In our research, when we look at reports of how an adult thinks a child is doing and compare that to how a child reports that they're doing, those two reports have a very low correlation. They're almost not related at all. But what is related is how the adult thinks the child is doing and how the adult themselves reports that they are doing. I know that's kind of confusing and convoluted, but what that means is the adult's report really matches their own report of how they're doing, not how the child themselves is doing. So all of that tells us how important it is to hear from children themselves. And they are good at being able to tell adults about their symptoms and what they're going through.
That is really illuminating. Ask the kids how they're doing. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Betty Lai, psychologist and specialist in children's mental health following natural disasters. And, of course, that is key during climate change. Betty, what are some of the symptoms parents or educators look to know whether their children might need urgent help after a disaster?
Paying attention to distress and in any what we call impairments in functioning. So if your child is not able to do things that they were able to do before the disaster event itself, that is a good sign that it would be good to check in with somebody. And it's always great to check in with people who are experts in development, teachers. Teachers see a lot of children, and they'll be really well positioned to understand how other children are reacting to the same event. So keeping those lines of communication open is really important.
In one of your many studies over the last decade, you flagged an increase in sedentary behavior as part of PTSS. Or what does that mean? What does that look like in a child?
That could look like spending a lot of time playing video games, spending a lot of time watching TV, not really getting up and getting out of the house. So sedentary behavior is definitely an area that you want to pay attention to and that we've found is related to mental health. And some of the best ways to create positive mental health are to keep a child active. Now, this is really hard in a disaster because we know that playgrounds can get flooded or destroyed, for example. When we were in Galveston after Hurricane Ike, the school gyms weren't able to be repaired for a long time, and the gyms were being used for things like lunches because other areas of the building were under repair. So I want to forefront that issue because it is so important to pay attention to, but oftentimes activities like physical activity, the opposite of sedentary activity, oftentimes those sort of are put lower on the priority list, but our work is showing that those activities are so important for children's mental health, so we really need to think about that early on in terms of thinking about disaster recovery.
Are there implications leading from climate-driven disasters to more coping with drugs, alcohol, or even higher suicide rates in young people following a natural disaster like a hurricane?
That's a great question, Alex. We don't know the answer definitively for children. We have seen in adults that disasters are absolutely related to more negative health behaviors, including things like smoking or drug use. We did look at children after the Haiti earthquake, and we found that there was some relationship between having gone through the earthquake and later health behaviors, like the number of sexual partners that youth had, for example.
Well, that's understandable in a way. I mean, it happens during wartime as well. But I'm wondering, too, if a child is traumatized, and we know not all kids are. In fact, a minority of kids are going to have lasting damage from these things. But what happens when, as we know will happen in the future, we have more storms and repetitive heat waves and possibly floods that keep coming?
Yeah, I think you're raising such an important point, and one that we can predict. We can now plan for the fact that many children will experience one of these traumatic events in their lifetime. And given that, it only makes sense to really think about preventive care. What can we do now to help children prepare for the next event? And that really means focusing on social emotional functioning. So helping children have skills for coping with their emotions and having positive coping strategies, like being able to talk about their emotions, being able to identify things that help them feel better, how to bolster their social support and draw on friends and caring adults in their lives. And those are all skills that are helpful generally in life, but are especially important after you experience a big event like a disaster.
Well, I noticed your study used information and contacted the kids through schools, and I began wondering, well, I guess schools are supposed to be part of the solution to those kids that need help from PTSS after disaster. But then I'm thinking, well, right now during the pandemic, those schools are closed. So if we get a hurricane and schools are closed, we could have trouble dealing with all this.
Absolutely. And all of this points to how central schools are in children's lives, and in a really good way. You know, as just a data point on this, when we looked at, and this wasn't my work, but work of other researchers, you know, they looked at children after Hurricane Katrina. And there was a nonprofit that was started that offered sort of our gold standard treatment for post-traumatic stress symptoms to children who were reporting distress. So they offered them this treatment for free in the community and in schools. There were sort of two options that you had. When children were referred out to the community, far fewer children actually took up those services, even though they were reporting distress. So only 37% of children accessed services when they were located offsite outside of school. But when those services were offered in schools, 98% of children and families took up the services. So just that simple shift of where services were located made a huge difference for children and families. And keep in mind that services were free in both conditions.
Well, it looks like we're coming into tumultuous times with a climate shifting. Can you think of ways that parents listening can help prepare their children to deal with possible impacts if their kids get PTSS?
I think in order to prepare, I think there are a few things that parents could do right away. And one is a very simple strategy of monitoring the news that children are exposed to. Especially in disaster events, you know, there can be sort of a 24-hour news cycle of a lot of disaster reporting. And research does show that that is predictive of distress for children. So even just watching something happening on the news can cause distress for children. So if parents can keep the TV off and make sure that they know and have pre-screened what's happening on the news, can be really helpful for children. Another strategy is coming up in advance. If you're in a disaster-prone area, making sure you know what your evacuation plan is really important, and also knowing what your evacuation plan is for your pets. A lot of times, pets are sort of forgotten until later, and that becomes really problematic if you have to evacuate quickly. And we know from the work on bushfires that you mentioned earlier, concern about pets and what's happened to them is actually a major predictor of children reporting post-traumatic stress symptoms after disaster. Also, making sure that you are helping to bolster a child's social support network is something that you can do right now, even regardless of whether you might experience a disaster. Social supports are so important for children, and they really help them through these potentially traumatic events.
Dr. Betty Lai, do you think the experience of children during natural disasters is getting enough attention?
I think there's growing focus on how these events can impact children. And the pandemic actually is really highlighting how important and central schools are for children's mental health. I feel strongly that there could always be more attention and more investment in children's mental health through schools. As an example, we don't have enough school counselors in this country, in the U.S., where I'm based right now. You know, the American School Counselor Association recommends that school counselors have a caseload of 250 students, but there are only two states in the United States that meet that ratio, and those two states happen to be pretty rural, so they have a lower student population. So for the most part, school counselors in the United States have far more students than they should have, than is recommended. And that does matter because we find that when school counselors have high caseloads, the children in those schools are less likely to finish high school, go to college, get good grades, basically all of the outcomes that we care about for children. So really focusing more attention and funding towards school counseling is one major preventive act that we could all take right now to help children.
Yes, I wish we'd done that already, because now coming back from the pandemic, a lot of kids are going to need our help as well. Now, the study we've been talking about looked at kids in the United States, but the whole world is experiencing unstable weather as the climate shifts. Is there much international work in this field? And can developing countries really do much to help their kids struggling after disasters?
The short answer is that we need more research in all countries to understand these issues. We recently put out a paper looking at the international guidelines for post-traumatic stress, and we really emphasized how we have limited information on low- and middle-income countries and how traumatic events are impacting children. In the case of disasters, that's really worrisome and a key gap that we need to address with research, because we know that disaster events can have an even greater impact in low- and middle-income countries. So we definitely need more work across the board internationally.
Betty, what brought you to this work?
I am a former school teacher myself, and I've always been really interested in how we can support children through all of life events. But I was a graduate student in Miami, where there are a lot of hurricanes that happen. But the first major piece that brought me to this work, I think, was the fact that Hurricane Ike hit Galveston, Texas, which was a location that I'd actually spent my childhood summers at. So that felt really close to home for me, and I really wanted to understand how we could help the community recover from a big event like a hurricane.
We have been speaking with Dr. Betty Lai, assistant professor at Boston College, trained clinical psychologist, expert on children's mental health following natural disasters. You can find links to learn more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Betty, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How long can you live without food? How will we feed billions of people without fossil fuels? so many big questions that lead directly to your dinner and your health. Dee Dee Pearsehaus has some answers for us. She's an American author, soil strategist, and teacher. Dee Dee founded the Land Leadership Initiative and literally gets to the roots that feed us all. From Vermont, Dee Dee Pearsehaus, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
We have so much on our minds, a pandemic, millions out of work, politics and stress. Why should perhaps city listeners take time to care about dirt?
Well, I like to actually call it soil. Dirt is what I call it when it's really degraded. And the difference between degraded dirt and healthy living soil is really the difference between something that is dead and alive. And that creates huge both structural and functional differences. So dirt, you could say, is just the sand, silt, and clay, the broken down rock particles that are sitting there in a dusty parking lot or a degraded farm as well, or ranch. If you think of that as being like flour, like the flour you might use for baking, if it's just those loose particles and you put that out in the rain or a big wind came along, they would move and blow away or roll away when that water or wind came along. And anyone who's done any baking knows that the water wouldn't soak in either. It would just run off the top. And so you're getting there in a landscape scale, you're getting flooding short term with the rain, so flash flooding. You're getting erosion, but you're also getting drought because the water's not sinking down in for the plant roots. Now, when you add life to that, if you have plants growing there, they photosynthesize and create sugars to both to build and grow themselves, and then also to feed all of life above the ground. But a large amount of their sugars goes down below the ground to feed other organisms. And those organisms move through the soil. We're talking about bacteria and fungi and a lot of other microscopic organisms, which then form the soil food web that all is eating each other and excreting nutrients for the plants as they move around, and they are getting nutrients from the minerals. But in that living process, there are all of these slimes and glues that all living things exude. And those slimes and glues and those little root hairs and fungal hyphae, which form threads, all tie those little sand, silt, and clay pieces together into a living matrix that has structural integrity. So it can't blow away, it can't roll off with water, but it also starts to have spaces in between. And those spaces, those little pore spaces, those little tunnels underground are where it all happens. You have air and water underground, and that's what you need for life. So it can soak up the water. Like I say, if I started off talking about flour, if you think of a few slices of bread stacked on top of each other, that's what happens when you have living soil. It's like turning flour into bread. It's taking something that has no structural or functional integrity and turning it into this matrix that stays together and absorbs things and doesn't fall apart when it's wet or when the wind blows. And life happens in there, and then life keeps building it. So it's continually regenerating itself.
And if you don't have that living soil, I just want to pass on a little information that I found for our listeners. Two Canadian news outlets analyzed food grown 50 years ago to find out how it compares to what we buy in supermarkets now. And essential vitamins and minerals were hardly there. Their report says, the Globe and Mail newspaper, the average potato has lost 100% of its vitamin A, which is important for eyesight, 57% of vitamin C and iron, which you need for healthy blood, 28% of calcium, and so on. Dee Dee, does that match what you know about American food today?
Yes, that is true. And that also has to do with the work that's going on underground. I've got an article, recent article on Medium called Other Species Are Essential Workers, Whose Economies Enfold Our Own. And a big piece of that essential work is those microscopic organisms that extend the plant's root system out, break down the tiny rock particles and get the nutrients from them, pass them through the soil food web and back to the plant, and exactly the right ratios and the timing that the plant needs them, because plants, just like people, need different nutrients at different times depending on what illnesses they're facing. Plants
face viral illnesses, bacterial illnesses, fungal illnesses, genetic problems, stresses. So when a plant has all of those symbionts or symbiotic organisms working with it underground, it can get way more nutrients, but it also gets them in the proportions and the important ratios and in the time that it needs them the most. So plants will become much more resistant to disease. And then everything that eats the plants, including us, will also become more resistant to disease. And it's not just the big nutrients like calcium and vitamins, et cetera. There are lots and lots and lots of phytochemicals and micronutrients that we're learning about. Like you hear about superfoods that have certain things in them. We are just beginning to scratch the surface of understanding all of the different things that plants make that contribute to the health of everything else on Earth.
You took your soil teaching to India, to the state of Andhra Pradesh, where the zero-budget natural farming movement is blossoming. Please tell us, what is that zero-budget natural farming?
So zero-budget natural farming started with a teacher named Subhash Palikar, and Andhra Pradesh adopted that along with some other agroecological principles, some of which came out of the teachings of a colleague of mine and I, Walter Yena and I. That they were sort of inspired by our work on the soil sponge and on how water may be available to plants under drought conditions if we understand those symbiotic relationships. The basic foundation of zero-budget natural farming is the idea that everything that's needed for a farm or a garden can be sourced from within the village without relying on big companies for seeds, for fertilizer, or pesticides, etc. So it's kind of organic plus. All the seeds are things that are sourced locally. Instead of fertilizer, they use biostimulants made out of forest soils, cow dung and cow urine, herbs, etc., mixed together, fermented. The seeds are coated with those. The plants are sometimes sprayed with those. The soil is treated with those as needed. And then they make herbal pesticides when they're in transition, but over time, they also plant different families of plants all in the same place. So there's a much more diversity and different sizes and shapes of plants within the same plot of land. So what that does is it tends to attract the insects to one part of the farm and away from the crop that's just ripening. It attracts insects that eat the ones that like to eat the crops. Because one of the things we've learned about pesticides, the work of Claire Lacan and John Lundgren found that the more pesticides, the more like insecticides that are used on a crop, the more pests are found in the field. And the reason for that is there's insects that eat plants and there are insects that eat insects. So if you kill off all the insects, who still has food left? The ones that eat the plant have food left. The ones that eat other insects don't have any food left. So the plant-eating ones will return first from other places. They'll come back from other places, or they will multiply in place from the populations that are left. So when we use different strategies that invite the diversity of insect life, you actually have way fewer pest problems over time. So these are some of the innovative ideas that they're using in Andhra Pradesh, including a lot of the soil health principles, so reducing tillage, always having cover crops growing, and now they have started, as I said, a lot of diversity, but they've also started planting things ahead of time before the seasonal rains, something that they're calling pre-monsoon dry sowing. That means that they can get a full crop in before the conventional farms. They're doubling farmers' incomes and even increasing the amount of food that's grown because they've reduced or eliminated pesticides, the health of the whole system, human health and ecological health, are both getting much, much better. It's now called community-managed natural farming in the Andhra Pradesh community-managed natural farming movement because they've taken that ZBNF or ZBNF and adapted it specifically for these projects in Andhra Pradesh.
Well, this is also exciting for people around the world, really, because it also has big implications for climate change. All those fertilizers and the pesticides are made from fossil fuels or with a lot of fossil fuels, and then you have to transport them around the world, more fossil fuels, and the soil becomes a net emitter of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases instead of becoming something that can capture carbon dioxide out of the air. Talk to us about the relationship between soil health and climate change.
Yes, absolutely. So as you said, well, there's the machinery involved, which is one thing, but there's also the inputs. All of the fertilizers and pesticides rely on fossil fuels for both the raw materials and the manufacturing. But then there are other things that people don't tend to think about so much and that often haven't been counted in this accounting of agriculture's impact on climate. So when you till the soil, soil carbon is the living, the dead, and the very dead in the soil. So all of those living organisms in the soil, including things like earthworms, when they die off, the carbon that was in their bodies goes back into the air. So when you till the soil, you are breaking up those fungal hyphae that are so key for the plant's nutrients. You are exposing bacteria that don't want to be exposed to heat, to up to the sunlight and the heat and air, and you're killing off a lot of life in the soil, as well as nesting birds and mice and other little small mammals in the area. And then the soil carbon, the organisms that like to eat the dead carbon or the air, organic matter, those ones tend to come to life with tillage and start eating. And so then you're even destroying even more of the carbon in the soil. So just tillage alone is a big, big problem in terms of soil carbon. And we've lost a lot of soil carbon, and along with that, a lot of the fertility and the structural and functional integrity of what I like to call the soil sponge. That's that. If we go back to my first example, that's the bread example.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dee Dee Pearsos, and we're talking about soil and climate and your food and your health. Lots to cover here. I'd like to get in just a little bit of news again on the nexus of the climate movement and Indian farming. We have the young Indian climate activist Disha Ravi was arrested in the middle of February. Her supposed crime was providing a toolkit for farmers protesting new agricultural legislation. And other activists from Extinction Rebellion in India had their homes raided and computers taken. Do you have any ideas, Dee Dee, on why the government of India is now attacking climate activists?
I don't understand that situation very well, but what I have heard, and this may or may not be accurate, is that legislation is really favoring the big international corporations that provide the input, and it is taking away the subsidies for the farmers to do their more traditional small farming. By taking away those subsidies, they are basically making it so that those farmers can't exist and bigger companies can swoop in and buy up the land. Land is at a premium right now for a variety of reasons, but you know, climate change, we're losing fertile land dramatically every year. We're losing the water systems that go with that. And to complicate things, there are now these soil carbon markets emerging. And so there are companies that are setting the rules and prices for soil carbon, but then at the same time buying up land so that they can do their own practices there and get those carbon credits. So it's a pretty complex ecosystem. You know, we want soil carbon to be growing. We do want farmers to get paid for rebuilding, regrowing the soil sponge, which provides all kinds of climate mitigation as well, which we haven't gotten into yet. But when people start making their own rules and then buying up all of the, you know, all of the playing pieces in the game, it's just more of the same that created this in the first place. I may not have everything straight there, but that's what it sounds like is going on to me.
It is very complex. You know, on the one hand, I can see that India's food distribution system needs some help. They lose, I've heard, up to 50% of their crops because they don't have refrigeration and distribution systems in. And it's complicated because they have hundreds of millions of small farmers who may have only an acre or 2 acres. We don't want to see a big enclosure movement like happened in the UK and have these people booted off their land. There's nowhere for them to go. It's a really, really hard situation. But when we come back to America, maybe we can see the future of Indian soil in the soy and cornfields of Iowa and other Midwestern states. What do you see in the U.S. agribusiness system when it comes to soil?
The U.S., a lot of our cropland isn't being used to grow food, first of all. It's being used to grow biofuels and things that make things that aren't useful for food, like high fructose corn syrup or cattle feed. You know, feed for animals that really should be, the animals should be part of growing a grassland. And a grassland can sequester tons of carbon, can hold water, can cool the region through transpiration, can provide flood resilience and drought resilience if it's managed well, if it's managed with holistic decision making or something that really understands how land works. So if we were to manage U.S. farmland with these more rational frameworks for decision-making, where we understand what are all the externalities here by doing this choice versus that one, not can I extract more value, not just how much yield can I have here, but what is the impact on the whole system? If we could understand that and make our choices with a bigger frame to look through, then I think we have a chance at changing how weather works, what the temperature regions are, perhaps changing the global climate, but certainly providing much more climate resilience. But currently, farmers in the U.S. are basically being paid to fail. They get payments when they have losses from flooding and drought. And I'm not saying we should cut those out right away. We need to figure out something that takes their place. But crop insurance subsidies is a huge piece of farmer income. Farmers have to go into terrible debt every year to buy all of these inputs, and then their margins of what they get in return are very tiny. So U.S. farmers are being squeezed in terrible ways by the current system, and there are people who are figuring it out. But I do think that what we're seeing in Andhra Pradesh, India, of having a whole state that is going towards natural farming is a real model for the U.S. and the rest of the world, that I think they have figured out something about people leading this movement that we're not quite there yet in the States. In the States, it's a lot more like what's called in the soil health movement, the herd quitters. So people who tend to go against the usual status quo, who are experimenting with this, rather than it being like, let's all do this together. So we need to figure out something about working together in the States.
You know, another sort of hopeful sign is that some of the billionaires of America, Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, are waking up to the fact that climate change is going to wipe out the base of their business and a lot of the population, possibly, if we don't get this under control. But they're looking for carbon capture and storage technology. They picture great big machines that are chewing up the air and sucking out the carbon. Whereas there is a fairly going group in New England and in other places of America and around the world who want to get this carbon capture into the soil with the kind of techniques that you teach. What have you seen in your region?
I would say that the big thing there is understanding that nature invented carbon capture technology long ago. It's called a plant, and it's also called people. So like each of us is sequestering carbon for 50 to 100 years in our bodies. Like if you start to understand that carbon is not a bad thing, carbon is the building block of life. And it's just that we need the right amount of carbon in living systems. And we need some carbon in the air. If we don't have carbon, CO2 in the air, plants can't continue to feed living systems. So it's about getting the carbon in the right place, in the right forms, at the right times, and have it flowing through the system rather than seeing it as something bad, or even that it's bad in the air and it's good in the soil. It's not a bad or good thing. It's about understanding how living systems work. So an example in New England that we're seeing is that there's a movement I find quite disturbing of cutting down forests and burning them as a clean technology, and then maybe getting even carbon credits for that without understanding that trees are carbon that has been captured, and that trees provide a lot of other things besides carbon storage or fuel, that every plant that is photosynthesizing is also transpiring water. And transpiring water is like sweating. It's what you do to cool off when you're too hot, and plants do that as part of the photosynthesis process. So that takes water that's in a liquid form that they've taken up from their roots and soil, and it turns it into a vapor, into a gas. And in that process, it actually removes a huge amount of heat from the surface of the leaves or the pine needles, but also from the air around it. And so forests are the, and trees in cities, et cetera, are like enormous air conditioners. So if we cut down the trees because it's a cleaner fuel, if we cut them down en masse, I'm not talking about carefully managed forests, but we are actually going to heat up the climate in New England very, very drastically. And we're going to completely disrupt the water cycle, because those forests also provide bacteria through that transpiration stream that goes up into the air and helps rain clouds to form and raindrops to fall. There's only three ways to make something big enough to fall down out of the sky as a raindrop. There's salts, which happen over the oceans. There's ice, which happens usually at higher altitudes. And there are these hygroscopic bacteria that can bring enough water to them as they're floating in the air to make something large enough to fall as a raindrop. And those come from forests. And if we don't, if we cut down our forests to solve one little piece of the problem, and don't understand all the other things that they're doing, we're going to have a hot, dry desert on the East Coast in the Northeast. It's happened all over the world. This is how deserts are formed. You can see places where the rainfall has stopped, and it goes, moves around where there used to be a forest to go find the place where there are the trees. So it's a big issue in the Northeast.
Dee Dee, you give so many workshops around America and in other countries, and many of them are available as free videos on your website. But how have you adapted during the pandemic?
Well, luckily, I had actually already shifted to doing a lot more online teaching through the Land and Leadership Initiative, which you can find at landandleadership.org. The and is spelled out. What's fun about teaching online is that we get people from all over the world working together. So my classes are very participatory. It's not just me spewing out information and people trying to digest it. People learn by working in small groups, thinking through their own experiences with forests, with land, with farming, with food, with their own economics, and then building together this picture of how living systems work. And what happens in the process is these amazing communities form of the people who've taken that course together. This last one that I taught last week, we had folks from Mongolia and Sweden and England and all over the U.S. and in India. And it's just really fun to hear how things work in other places, what people are trying in other places. So there's a lot of learning that happens from participant to participant, rather than me trying to be an expert. I always say there's no experts here. Like, we're all the expert of our own context, and you can learn from every single person in this course.
In your books, like The Ecology of Care, soil health and human health come together. In fact, those two are part of your personal life experience. What is the medical connection to a soil strategist?
Well, a lot of people think that it's an issue of that the soil bacteria literally are the same as the bacteria in our guts that we've learned are so important. That's not entirely true, because most soil bacteria are more aerobic and most of our gut bacteria are anaerobic. So it's not quite as direct as that, but it goes more to, in terms of the nutritional piece, more to what we were talking about earlier, that the soil bacteria and soil fungi and all of the soil life makes sure that the plant is getting optimal nutrition at every minute in that moment around the plant. And of course, if we eat locally and we eat plants that are grown in a healthy system, then we are getting the nutrition that we need to deal with the illnesses that are in that same ecosystem at that same time. So that's one piece. But then the other thing is that all of these effects of climate change, the flooding, the drought, the wildfires, the water shortages, the food shortages, the conflicts over resources and the trauma and stresses that go along with that, with forced migration, those can all be addressed by having a soil sponge, by having a functional living matrix of soil. Every single one of those, including the issues of too much CO2 in the atmosphere. So each one of those things carries with it, takes a toll on human health. Every single one of those things I just listed has health impacts along with it. So by addressing, by regenerating the soil sponge, we can address all of the health impacts as well as all of the things that we need going forward to regenerate life on this planet. Diverse, beautiful life that does all the work that happens on the planet.
Of course, we're running out of time too soon. What have you got coming up and how can listeners tune into your work?
Okay, well, I have a couple of different websites that people might be interested in. One is landandleadership.org, and that's where you will find some resources that we've been putting together that you can read more about, articles that I've written there, or you can find those also on medium.com under Dee Pursehouse. I've got classes that start every couple of weeks. We are now also starting a 6-month intensive program that some people are joining who've just taken classes with me. And then I have a personal website, ddpursehouse.com, where you can find more videos of talks that I've given and links to my 2 books. And then there's another website called rehydratecalifornia.org that is not as active of a website, but has some very interesting resources. And that's kind of a spot that I've helped create for multi-stakeholder initiatives looking at rehydrating arid and semi-arid areas like California through growing the sponge, through collaborating with other species, and through collaborating with each other.
If you missed any of that, I'm going to put all kinds of links in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dee Dee, it's been really great to finally connect with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, wonderful. And hope everybody out there will stop disturbing the soil, create diverse plants that are growing all around. More diversity is better. And any soil that's there, make sure that something's growing there. Doesn't matter what it is. Just let it grow.
I'm doing that in my back food garden. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Welcome to new listeners on FM 104.9 The Gig in Modesto, California, pumping out the best of local bands to the world and Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you, everyone, for listening this week and caring for your world.